Tonight's talk will be a sort of continuation of this guided meditation I had the other day. So it's because it's going to be about Buddhism and the inner and outer nature. So many years ago, 1986 I think it was, I stayed for 6 months at a monastery in southern Thailand called Wat Suan Mok. Maybe some of you have been there. And the abbot and teacher there was Ajahn Buddhadasa, a quite famous and influential monk in Thailand. And he was also very progressive and open-minded, and he spoke quite good English. So many Westerners came to this monastery to practice, and some even ordained as monks and meichis, the kind of nuns that they have in Thailand. And they used to have, I don't know if they still do, but I think so, they have retreats the first 10 days of every month. So there's a lot of hippies coming there. It was sort of it was in this travel book that everybody's having, you know.
Lonely Planet?
Yeah, Lonely Planet, that's right. It was in there. So many people came, but not everybody stayed for the whole 10 days because it was quite primitive place and a bit tough. Anyway, Ajahn Buddhadasa was already 80 years old, so he wasn't that healthy. He was still teaching a little bit. We got to see him maybe once a month or something. He would have a open meeting with the Westerners, and then anyway, he died some years later in 1993. When he came to the site where the monastery is, there was only jungle there, and there was an old overgrown stupa, you know, this kind of Buddhist monument, a stupa. There's usually some relics inside, but this was very old and overgrown with plants and jungle. So he just came there by himself and started living there as a monk. And then people from the neighboring villages started to come, and because the rumor spread that it was this enlightened monk living there, and then I guess, you know, things started happening, and this monastery formed, and a lot of the surrounding jungle was cut down, and there was rice fields and villages. And some years before I came there, the government decided to build a big road that cut across the country there, right outside the gates of the monastery. And there was a lot of protests about this, but they built it anyway. So that's what it looked like around the monastery, but the actual site of the monastery was still very a lot of jungle there, and a lot of rare species of flowers and animals, some really big varan, what are they called? Some, we talked about them. Yeah, and there was another funny animal there that looked like a cross between a rabbit and a deer, very small like this. I saw it once. It was very, very difficult to see. And the monks' cottages, you know, they all have little kutis, it's called, little houses on stilts. They were also nestled in the jungle with just little path going across, going from their kutis. And every day you had to sweep those paths because there were lots of scorpions and these caterpillars and things that could hide under the leaves, you know. In Thailand, in those countries, the leaves are falling all the time. It's never sort of a season for falling leaves. It's always new and old leaves. So you have to sweep the path every day. So that's one of the sounds I remember from this time, was this swoosh, 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 this sweeping of leaves all the time. So I just remembered all this. I mean, this is quite long ago, but very recently I came across this quote from Ajahn Buddhadasa, so that's why I remembered all this. And since he died in 1993, I mean, he must have written this before that, which was, I guess, quite early. He says, "The entire cosmos is a cooperative. The sun, the moon, and the stars live together as a cooperative. The same is true for humans and animals, trees, and the earth. When we realize that the world is a mutual, interdependent, cooperative enterprise, then we can build a noble environment. If our lives are not based on this truth, then we shall perish." So that's what Ajahn Buddhadasa wrote. So in this urban industrial society where many of us live, it's very easy to forget that our survival is completely bound to the earth. Despite all our technological inventions and, you know, all this, the photosynthesis of plants is still the fundamental prerequisite for life, because it produces the oxygen that we breathe and the food we eat and all other materials that we need. So that's why I think that one way of finding this true refuge that we're looking for is to connect deeply with the earth, with Mother Nature, to embrace the notion that we ourselves are part of nature. We are nature. And our inner nature needs to connect with the outer nature to feel balanced and healthy. In the world today, more and more people live in cities. I mean, even in countries like India and in Asia and so, people leave their villages and move into the cities. So the cities grow really a lot. So people that live in the cities seldom see any real forests or any wild animals or so on. In those mega big cities in Asia, there are hardly any parks or anything like that either. So people are really disconnected from nature. And the kids, especially here in the West maybe, but also in Asia, kids spend a lot more time inside in front of screens of different kinds. And then they spend outside playing in nature. A common view of nature is that it's only there to provide us humans with the raw materials for our industries. And for that purpose we are destroying and plundering the earth. In Buddhism, there is no myth of creation. You know, most religions or have some sort of creator or some story about how the earth was created and so on. But in Buddhism, we don't have that. It's like the universe has existed for such a long time and gone through so many changes that the actual creation of it is not relevant anymore. So because of this, there is no higher authority or God that has appointed us humans to somehow to own or be the caretakers of the earth or the stewards of the earth. So Buddhism sees mankind as an integral part of nature. And here Buddhism resembles the old shamanic cultures and animistic religions that have been practiced by indigenous people all over the world and still is in certain places. So among Native Americans, this relationship between humans and earth have been emphasized, for example, in this very well-known speech by Chief Seattle, which he held at a meeting with the white people in Washington, 1854. Maybe you have heard it before, but it's quite a good one. So this Indian chief said, "This we know, the earth does not belong to man. Man belongs to the earth. This we know, all things are connected. Whatever befalls the earth befalls the children of the earth. Man did not weave the web of life. He is merely a strand in it. Whatever he does to the web, he does to himself." So that's what we're doing now. We do to the web, we do to ourselves. And this web or net is a very old symbol of the interconnectedness of life. So in the Buddhist mythology, it's the net of the god Indra. You know, in the mythology there are some of the Indian gods, but they're not gods that sort of that have any power. It's more like a mythology. And the god Indra, he has this net which has a pearl in every mesh reflecting all the other pearls. So that's also a symbol of this interconnectedness. And here in Scandinavia, we have the web of Urd, who is the eldest of the Norn goddesses of destiny. I don't know if you have the same in Finland, but as the Scandinavian Asatru. And Native Americans have Spider Woman. And nowadays we also have the World Wide Web. That's our symbol of this interconnectedness. So how do we go about connecting with inner and outer nature? Well, what we do here, meditation, is of course one good way to turn the attention inward and to observe what is happening in our own mind and body. And by this attentive observation, we start seeing our psychological patterns and reactions and motivations. We can also start understanding how thoughts drive our lives, especially if we always believe in them, of course. But by now you've probably discovered that thoughts are a bit deceptive. You can't always believe what they say. And thinking is, of course, very necessary often and useful in some time. And thinking is a natural part of the function of the mind. But thoughts can also be deceptive and egotistical and lead us to perform actions that are not so skillful, towards ourselves and towards other beings. So meditation can help us to see this, to discern what is helpful and what is not helpful. But one of the most significant things that meditation can do is give us these deep insights into our connectedness and interdependence to the rest of the world, to all other beings, to animals, trees, to nature itself, which I mentioned about the dependent origination theory, which is one of the Buddhist core teachings that is about this. And this we can also see for ourselves. So our well-being depends on a healthy earth. But nowadays some people seem to believe that making money is more important than taking care of the earth. So this pollution and climate change is something that scientists have long warned us about. And now, recently, as they sort of slowly began to be accepted by people and maybe even some politicians, that we are in this global ecological crisis. We're living in the age of mass extinction of many species, and our seas are choking with plastic waste. And in many of our large cities, the air is not fit to breathe, and fresh drinking water is becoming scarce. Like in Delhi and Chennai in India, it's really bad. I stayed 3 days in Delhi and I felt really sick. I couldn't imagine how people could live there with the air. It's like a mist all over the city. When you look in the distance, you see that it's the air is just so polluted. And this climate crisis is also a psychological crisis. Climate anxiety is this new and not so uncommon condition, according to many psychologists and also meditation teachers. And the human psyche has difficulty taking in and dealing with such seemingly insoluble and gigantic problems. People feel like dejected, sad, and powerless when they read or hear the news about all the terrible things that can happen and are already happening. The fact is that the environmental disasters are underway in many places, mainly in the poorer countries in Asia, Africa, South America. And now also the latest news I heard is that the forests in Siberia are burning, which is really dangerous. And So large corporations, mainly Western and Chinese, are exploiting natural resources without regard of the livelihood of the local populations. So this small-scale fishing and farming are destroyed. Without caring about nature or human beings, they grab raw materials, land, oil, precious metals, or whatever it may be, leaving the country desolate and poisoned. Even in Sweden there is, and I think also in Finland I've heard, there are examples like that. In Sweden there was this mining scandal in Kaunisvaara, in Lapland, because this mining company, Northland, they started a mine there and dug up the earth and, you know, destroyed a lot of nature. And then they went bankrupt in 2014 because the price of this metal, whatever it was too low on the world market or something. So then they just left everything, because and there was no money. So you know, there was this poisoned nature, big area poisoned nature, and a lot of local investors that had believed in this lost their money, and we, the taxpayers, have to pay the bill for cleaning up. And some of this can't even be cleaned up because there's already so much destroyed that it's leaking, you know, into the groundwater and things like that. So it's really terrible. And so I saw now on the internet that, you know, there's another mine company that wants to start a mine in Gallok, in Lapland, Swedish Lapland. And now there are about 1,500 young people from the rainbow gatherings that came there to Jokkmokk, this tiny little place. Or, yeah, it's pretty small. So, to protest against this. It's quite incredible, actually. So these capitalist corporations who work with this short-term greed and an unwillingness to see far-reaching consequences of what they do is what we have to deal with or try to reform in some way, change in some way, if we're going to manage to save life on Earth in the form we know it. Otherwise, Mother Earth may continue existing without us when we have destroyed all our living conditions, such as clean water, clean air, soil that we can grow food in, trees and plants that produce oxygen, and all these other very fragile ecosystems where humans, animals, and plants interact in different ways. But will it be possible to change a system and an ideology that people have been indoctrinated to believe in for so long? That need for constant growth, the exploitation of nature's resources that is said to lead to new jobs, higher living standards, and so forth. But actually that's usually a lie. Those jobs are for very short periods of time, and the living standard is actually going down instead. So can this development stop before it gets too late? Are there any alternatives? So the common solution proposed by politicians is the development of more environmentally friendly technologies, and that's definitely necessary. And we already have a lot of solar, wind, and all these kind of things. And but I don't think that only technology is enough to create a sustainable ecological society. What no politician or business executive dares to say is that we probably have to sacrifice some of our high consumption lifestyle and start living within the boundaries of what the earth can give and regenerate. As it is now, you know, I think about a month ago I read that now we have used up the resources that we actually have for this year. So for the rest of the year we're living on taking resources from the future that the earth can't regenerate within this life, this span of time. There are also other more creative voices and that are saying exactly that humanity have to move from this nature exploiting and growth based industrial societies to more sustainable and life affirming communities. And there's also a movement trying to create a new ethic that considers the rights of non-human beings, the rights of animals, plants, and ecosystems to exist, to thrive, and to be in balance. You know, there is the UN Declaration of Human Rights, and that really needs to be supplemented with the Declaration of Nature's Rights, because they really go together. And violation of nature's rights is called ecocide, and the word is formed in the same way as homicide and genocide, to kill people or groups of people. So ecocide means to kill nature. And if laws against ecocide were instituted, it would be possible to sue people who commit crimes against nature, such as politicians or CEOs of big corporations, because they can very often hide behind their organizations and avoid taking responsibility for the consequences of their decisions. And it would also provide the opportunity for such decision makers, politicians or CEOs and so on, who really want to change this principle that's now the principle for a corporation is maximum profit. And that's very hard to change, because if a CEO from a company takes, you know, decisions that make the profits less, they probably get fired. But if there was a law, so they could say, well, we can't take this decision because the law says we can't do it, so then they could have, it would be easier to take decisions that are in favor of nature and not only of the shareholders. And there are things happening, that positive things happening too, like quite recently the government of India has decided to give the holy rivers Ganges and Yamuna and their ecosystems legal rights, which means that they have the right, same right as a human being. And the Whanganui River in New Zealand has also been granted legal rights following a legal process that's been going on for 100 years. between those the indigenous people, the Maori, and the state of New Zealand. And now finally the this river has gotten its rights, and it's sacred for the Maorians, and they want to stop this industrial pollution of this river. So this ideological foundations for creating another kind of society are already largely built into Buddhism. The Noble Eightfold Path, which is sort of the core teaching, is a middle way between materialistic consumerism and excessive asceticism. So the basic message of the Eightfold Path is to protect life, to have a livelihood that doesn't hurt anyone, and to ennoble the mind through meditation. So living a simple but good life in harmony with nature, with animals and fellow human beings is the ideal that the Buddha talks about. And as I said, the basic idea of Buddhism is that everything is connected and depends on everything else for its existence. And then it's obvious that one should not destroy and pollute nature. In the time of the Buddha, which is like 2,600 years ago, they didn't have all the chemicals and plastic and all these polluting things that we have. But in the Vinaya, which is the rules for the monks and nuns, that he introduced rules that monks and nuns should not contaminate water or land with spit, urine, poo, or other waste materials that existed at that time. And there's also a rule that a monk or a nun should never break off branches or damage trees or destroy plants in general. And in the stories of the birth and life of the Buddha, one can read that he was born in a grove of high, beautiful salt trees. And as a child, there's a story about him meditating under a rose apple tree. And finally he reached enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, which is a species of fig tree. And finally he died under two salt trees in the village of Kusinara. And these trees started to bloom over his deathbed, though it was not in season. So different trees go like a red thread to the Buddha's life. So the Buddha also taught that the mind is the forerunner of everything. We create the world by living out the contents of our minds. I mean, you can see that very clearly, that wars, for example, comes from somebody's mind. Somebody has this idea that they have to kill some people or, you know, defeat another country or something. And then the idea comes from the mind, and then all these things happen. So the mind is the forerunner of everything. And in this small scripture called the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, "If one acts with a mind filled with greed, hate, and ignorance, suffering is an inevitable result. If, on the other hand, one acts with a mind filled with kindness, compassion, and wisdom, it will result in happiness. So one must realize that outer pollution is a reflection of internal mental pollution. If we want a clean external environment, we must adopt a lifestyle that comes from a moral and spiritual dimension and ideal of life, I think, anyway. And Buddhism already also has this very simple and clear moral code, the five training rules that we chanted in the beginning of the retreat. And you all have them on this little paper that's lying around. And so the Buddha clearly showed that the three so-called root poisons of the mind, greed, hate, and ignorance, should be transformed into generosity, kindness, and wisdom. And to that end, there are working methods to train the mind to develop concentration, mindfulness, calmness, and equanimity, which is so important for a peaceful and a non-violent based way to bring about change in ourselves and the society at large. And it is this training that we all undertake together on this retreat. So that's a good thing, I think, that we came together to do this. And the Buddha always urged his disciples to go out into nature and sit under the trees at the root of a tree to meditate. And this is something that we can also do if we want to. Trees provide a refuge, especially old big trees. And they even have a name in Pali language. It's called Vanaspati. And that means the ancestors of the forest. And they are especially worthy of respect. But all sorts of trees are worthy of respect and gratitude because they all give all these different gifts to us, you know. If you walk along this very sunny road and you come to the shade of a tree where you can rest for a while, that's a gift. And then there are fruits, seeds, and leaves and wood, all these things that the trees give us. In the Qigong that we're doing, you can also notice that the names of the movements all allude to natural phenomena like the rainbow, parting the clouds, the sun and the moon, the waves, the eagle, and so on. So these gentle movements also create harmony within our bodies and connects us to nature around us. So during the night when Prince Siddhartha, the future Buddha, he was the Prince Siddhartha before, and he sat under the Bodhi tree in this little village in northern India that's now called Bodh Gaya. And then Mara, this mythological figure, as Greg mentioned, the tempter, as always trying to stop people from meditating and so on. He came to the Buddha and because he wanted to make him doubt in his ability to sit there with this high aspiration of becoming a fully enlightened being. So he was saying to Buddha, sort of, who do you think you are sitting here, blah, blah. And he was trying to instill doubt, you know, the fifth of the hindrances. And then Siddhartha touched the ground with his right hand, calling on the earth goddess. And the earth goddess, at least in Thai, is Mai Dharani. Mai Dharani. And he called on her as his witness that he was in his full right to sit there on the earth and aspire for enlightenment. And this gesture, and it's called the mudra. You can see on, now we don't have any Buddha statue here, but if you see Buddha statues very often, they have this mudra where Buddha touches the earth with his right hand. And I see that as a sort of proof that the Dhamma, the teaching of the Buddha, is anchored here on earth. It's not something, you don't aspire to go to heaven or anything like that. It's the life here on earth that is the real thing. And it's what you do here and what karma you create and so on is important. So Buddhism is also not a religion that is averse to modern science and technology. It's not sort of fatalistic or backwards in any way. It gives people personal responsibility to shape their own lives and society through this law of karma, for example, cause and effect. What actions you do have an effect on the whole life. And so you know, Buddhism has always adopted to whatever culture it's come to, and now it's come to the West, and it's not trying to, you know, that we should live like they did in the time of the Buddha. It just sort of adopts our modern lifestyle and try to make the best out of that. So it's not striving to be to be backwards in any way. So there's about 376 million Buddhists in the world, I read somewhere. And in 10 countries, Buddhists are in the majority and should be able to influence politics. But so far, Bhutan, this little country up in the Himalayas, is the only country that has really taken advantage of this. And they have abolished this outdated economic instrument, gross national product, which only has to do with economy, and replaced it with gross national happiness, which includes everything, you know, also the happiness of the people, and not only the economic growth. And Bhutan has also implemented laws to protect their forests. So it says that Bhutan should always have about 70% forest covered land, which is very important, especially in these mountainous areas where if you clear cut and there are no roots of trees holding the land, you get all these landslides. And like Nepal has incredible problems with this because they've clear cut so much. So they have every year in the monsoon times, there are lots of landslides and whole villages can be buried by these big landslides. So I visited Bhutan for 2 weeks last year, and it's an amazing country. Actually, it's not perfect. It still has its problems, you know. It's a poor country, it's quite a poor country actually. But there is this great willingness and enthusiasm there to solve the problems and to do it for the benefit of the people and the nature. And it's a very clean, beautiful country. I mean, when you come, we came, I was traveling with a group and we came over land from India. And the contrast is just stunning, you know, because India nowadays is so polluted and so much trash, garbage everywhere, just thrown on the ground and so on. And then you cross over to Bhutan and it's all clean and nice and buildings are really nice, painted, and it's they really have a aesthetic eye there. So, what time is it? So Buddhists have a great potential to show alternative solutions to climate threats through both theoretical and practical examples. So what is needed is to somehow organize and mobilize these forces, I think, for the good of all living beings. But how should this happen? So I was surfing the internet to see if there were any especially Buddhist initiatives to do something about this environmental problem. And I found, I didn't do any scientific survey, I just sort of looked around a little bit. And I found some declarations and petitions, for example. One declaration from many international Dharma teachers from all different traditions is called The Earth as Witness, which is exactly that what I was talking about, the Buddha touching the earth as a witness. And another declaration is called The Time to Act is Now. And both of these declarations can be signed on the web if you wish. And it's been signed by many people. There's also something called the One Earth Sangha. And they also have some sort of courses of, if you want to be a Earth Protector, I think it was called, or something like that. And also quite interesting website where you can read a lot of things. And Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is the translator of the Tipitaka, and he also has some projects to change the economy into a more Buddhist kind of economy. And I also found a book from Wisdom Publications called A Buddhist Response to the Climate Emergency. And many well-known teachers have contributed with the different chapters, like Dalai Lama, Karmapa, Joseph Goldstein, and Jana Macy, and many others. And what all these writers agree on is that Buddhism already has many of the qualities needed to make a leading contribution to this climate struggle. And there is already a movement called Engaged Buddhism. It's been going on for quite a long time. And it's been so far mostly about creating world peace. And but now, I mean, world peace is very much dependent on this climate change. So this Engaged Buddhism was founded by a Theravada monk called Mahagoshananda from Cambodia, and Sulak Sivaraksha from Thailand, and Vietnamese Sen monk Thich Nhat Hanh, and Dalai Lama and Bhikkhu Bodhi and many others are now also engaged with this. And Joanna Macy, that I mentioned before, she is also a committed Buddhist and environmentalist from the United States, and who is a great inspiration for me. She's written a lot of books, and she teaches these workshops on the theme, the Great Turning, which means turning the society towards a more sustainable way to operate. And she often uses different ceremonies to bring people together in circles where they can explore their climate anxiety or find more peace and strength and in their connection to the earth and to what to do. One of these ceremonies is called the Council of All Beings. It's very interesting. And although ceremonies are not really a part of the Buddha's teaching, they can also be a refuge of sorts where one can meet like-minded people and share and learn from each other. Because retreats, very good of course, but they are mostly silent and mostly working inward. And we can only talk freely in the beginning and the end. But sometimes we also need more social gatherings to open our hearts and speak to other people about things that concerns us the most. So in the Sigalovada Sutta, the Buddha gives advice especially to lay people like us. And he says that the housekeeper should accumulate wealth in the same way as a bee collects pollen. The bee does not harm the scent, the petals, or the beauty of the flower, but collects nectar while at the same time pollinating the flowers. Similarly, we should do when we live and work in our society to avoid causing harm in our search for wealth, and we should use our wealth for everyone's benefit. So we just hope that there will be bees even in the future, because there is currently a mass death of bees and bumblebees, which probably is because of this cocktail of chemicals, herbicides and antifungal agents that they find in the pollen that the bees eat. So scientists believe that the cause of the mass death of these important pollinators are these chemicals. So in my opinion, the battle against pollution and climate change must be carried out on many different fronts. The practical, which means technical development, recycling and new inventions, and the legal, which implies the introduction of laws against ecocide, and the spiritual, which helps us to change our minds and our lifestyles towards a simpler, less materialistic and more sustainable kind of approach. So I hope that Buddhists can play a role in this necessary transformation towards a sustainable society, because the Dhamma also points to the important relationship between the individual and the society, that the personal and the social transformation must be done together. You can't have one without the other. And unlike some other religions who rely more on a ruling god, the Buddha gives people responsibility to direct their own lives towards a better future. And because everything in the world is interconnected, the future of the planet will also be affected of what people do. Like our retreat here can even affect the rest of the world in some way, since we are interconnected with everything. And so both the inner and the outer nature must come into balance. And I just want to add the thing for today, that today is the full moon. And in the Buddhist countries, the full moon day is called Uposatha, and the people celebrate it by going to the monasteries or temple, the local temple, and to practice meditation and maybe to feed the monks and listen to Dhamma talks and so on. And sometimes monks and may also lay people may stay up all night on the full moon night to meditate. So I'm not asking you to stay up all night, but if you have some energy after the chanting, you can stay a little longer anyway. and feel that power of the full moon is in the sign of Aquarius, which is also the future age, the age of Aquarius. So that was all for today, and thank you for listening. Now it's only 17 minutes for walking. Should we ring the bell a little later?
Let's add 10 minutes on, so let's ring the bell at 38.
Mm. Okay.
Start for a short question.
Well, okay.
Not the short, actually. Started already, so I can't click it anymore. Like we can all probably agree that the Buddhist teachings and the practices, they can transform people in really radical ways.
Mm.
But I think the problem is that the people who come to these retreats, they are already like pretty in touch with this.
I know.
Ecologically conscious. So I think the big challenge is like how to get this message to those people who don't.
Yeah.
From like the working class and the non-white communities.
Well, I mean, I don't have the solution for that, but it seems like this sort of the mindfulness movement now, the sort of secular mindfulness movement, is, I think, in that way, it's a good thing, because that gives people at least a taste of this way of looking inside themselves and not believing in all the thoughts and so on. And also, I don't think everybody has to be a sort of Buddhist or have the Buddhist ideas, because to turn a society, to turn things around, I think there is a critical mass of people that can do it. You know, sometimes it starts with one person. See, look at Greta, for example. So, you know, I don't know how and when it's going to happen, but hopefully it will happen when, even if not everybody is aligned to these ideas. So, I don't want to go on anymore, because now you have to go out and see the sunset and get some fresh air. And then welcome back to the chanting and last sitting. Oh, yeah, I know.